You all are kind of mixed about that, aren't you? Thanks be to God. I don't know. What did I do with that? All right. Well, we're very thankful for many things in the life of our church. For all of you who serve, we're thankful. Make sure when you see Hannah, you congratulate her. I love embarrassing her, so I find great joy in that. She just got engaged with her fiance Reese last weekend up in Skagit Valley, a field of tulips, beautiful picture, and it was really lovely. So we're excited for her. This coming week, Pastor Camille's going to be gone. She's going to be on a little trip down south to celebrate her daughter, who is graduating from Biola University. Yay! And Tuesday is her 30th wedding anniversary with John, so make sure you wish them happy anniversary before they get on the road, all right? So lots of good things happening in our life together. So, you know, Esther is, and with the passage you heard this morning from the book of Esther, is often told as a children's story. And even within the Jewish tradition, it's still told as a children's story in which children are deeply engaged during a feast that happens every year in the Jewish calendar called the Feast of Purim. And so there's dancing and games and all sorts of things. There's usually some role-playing. Someone gets to play Esther. Someone gets to play Mordecai. Someone gets to play even Haman in the story. But you just heard the story read from from Esther chapter 7. It's a story about genocide, careless leadership, patriarchy, and evil. Perfect for children. Perfect for children. Oh, my word. In the midst of all that, it's a story of remarkable courage. And Esther is the one who displays it in the story in a rich and powerful way. She stands alone. After a bit of waiting, as a woman of singular courage, and I want to center in her story today, as we learn how God's grace can come to us in vital, deep relationships. So let's talk first about how these relationships matter. Now, there are some weeks when y'all might listen to the podcast I do as the Bible study on this text, and it's helpful. This week's podcast on Esther was a bit necessary because in the podcast, I try to explain the entire book of Esther in the first 7 or 8 minutes of the podcast. So when we drop you into Esther chapter 7 this morning, you know what in the world's going on. Esther is a Jewish woman. And she is in Persia, which is a modern-day Iran, Iraq, we'll say. And this is after the Jewish exile. So the Jewish people in and around the city of Jerusalem were conquered by the Neo-Babylonian Empire in three different waves, 605, 597, 586 BCE, hauled off to exile in Babylon. After about 67 years in exile in Babylon, there was a regime change there. The Neo-Babylonian Empire fell, and the Persian Empire came to power. The Persian Empire came to power and said, God, we really don't want all you Jewish people here. Why don't you just go home? And so a group of those Jews returned back to Jerusalem. And you can read their stories in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah about those Jews who returned. But there were other Jews who did not return, Jews who stayed in Persia and built a life there after having been there for almost 70 years. Esther and her family are part of that Jewish community that remained in Persia. The king has a queen. Her name is Vashti. Long story, Vashti is no more. So now the king needs a new queen. So he basically holds a beauty contest to determine who his new queen will be, and Esther wins the contest. But Esther does not tell the king that she's Jewish. She conceals her Jewish identity. So as the story begins to unfold, we find our villain in the story, Haman. When I say Haman, everyone say boo. That's Haman, good. You're getting into the Feast of Purim. This is how it works, all right? So you boo Haman. He hatches a plot to exterminate the Jewish people. And the way he does it as the chief advisor to the king, his name is Ahasuerus, it's also called Xerxes. The way Haman goes about tricking the king is to get him to sign a decree The king thinks the decree only enslaves the Jewish people. But in fact, that very word used for enslavement can also mean annihilation. And so what Haman has in mind is to kill all of the Jewish people in Persia. Genocide is on his mind. And so the story begins to unfold in Esther about how Esther becomes the queen, conceals her Jewish identity, doesn't tell the king or anyone else that she's actually Jewish. Our villain in the story, Haman, this won't get old, trust me. He then goes about orchestrating the events that will lead to the genocide of all the Jews living in Persia. And as the story goes on in Esther chapter 1 and 2 and 3, all the way leading to chapter 7, Haman's evil plot gets closer and closer to reality. Things get worse for the Jewish people as the story goes on. And so here's where relationships matter. Here's where relationships matter. The king throws a banquet for Queen Esther, and this is his second attempt to throw a banquet for her. And during the banquet, the king asks her, "Ask me for anything you want up to half of my kingdom." And so in that moment, when King Ahasuerus is there, Queen Esther is there, and Haman is there, Esther finally asks for something. And this is where we learn that relationships matter. She says this, "If I have found favor in your sight," is what she says to King Ahasuerus. That sentence may not sound like much, and it's unfortunate that the Bible we read this morning, the Common English Bible, doesn't translate that Hebrew word correctly. Usually when you would speak to the king under Persian rule, you would address the king in the third person always. So if it were to follow form, Esther would have said, "If I have found favor in the sight of the king," while she's talking to him. Make sense? So he's talking about him in the third person. That's the formal way you're supposed to address the king, even if you're the queen, in public. Instead, she says this, "If I have found favor in your sight," the second person pronoun. She addresses him in public in an inappropriate way. She speaks to him out of intimacy, out of connection, out of relationship, not out of formality. She's not any petitioner making a request. She's the queen making a request of her husband. This is highly irregular. One would never address the king that way, especially in public, and she does. There's a closeness in the language she uses when she speaks to Ahasuerus. And God's grace begins to move in this episode as soon as she begins to address the king in this sort of fashion. I mean, think for a moment about those relationships in your own life that are like this, where you have a degree of connection or intimacy with other human beings. For those of you that are married, this could be your spouse. For those of you not married, this could be close friends. These could be people that you've shared life with. These are people that are knit into close connection with you. This kind of intimacy of relationship is different than the surface level kind of relationships. These are the relationships that have depth. And Esther takes this relationship of depth and she's going to pull a lever on it. And we need to think in our lives about those kinds of relationships that we might have, that have a depth to them, have a richness to them, have a meaning to them. So let me ask a couple of questions of you. And these are in your handout this morning. Where in our life are there durable relationships? With whom? What could we do to strengthen them? And how are we finding our way through demanding and controlling relationships? What might God's direction be? This story moves from putting a claim on how relationships matter to truth-telling. So while Queen Esther is standing there with the king, Ahasuerus, And Haman? Good, you're following along. Something happens. And what happens is truth-telling. Truth-telling. Now, let me tell you a story before I get into this. One of my best friends when I was going to college was a man named David Melton. David and I had met when I was in high school. And during my second year of college, he was, at that point, doing his master's degree in applied math. In my second year of college, as I shared with a Samaritans class a couple of weeks ago, I was in the middle of taking my first semester of Greek, and I was flunking out. I did so poorly in that class, I had to drop that class. And since I had discovered you could drop that class, I started dropping other classes. It's just a piece of paper, isn't it? During my second year of college, I completed a total of 9 semester units. That's it. 2 that spring semester, only 1 that fall semester. I had been called by God to ordained ministry when I was 17 years old. And so in order for me to do that in the tribe I was a part of in the United Methodist Church, I had to not only get my bachelor's degree, I had to get a Master of Divinity degree after that. So when I was 19 years old, I'm staring down the road of years and years and years of school before I eventually kind of reached that goal of being ordained. One night I was out with my friend David. I don't know where we were, but we had pulled into his driveway and we were sitting in his car. And David asked me, he said, "How are things going at school?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm not taking many units, blah, 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 you know, 19-year-old talk." And then David said to me, he goes, "Hasn't God called you to ministry, Craig?" And I went, "Yeah." And then David said, "Do you not understand that the only way that ministry will happen is when you finish school?" And I went, "What?" And David says, "The more time you waste right now, you're telling God that you're not going to answer his call till you're ready." Cut me to the heart. That's the kind of durable friendship I'm talking about. The kinds of relationships that we have with individuals that can speak a truth into us that no one else can speak. Not even our critics could speak that truth. Well, David was right. I went back to school full time. I did 4 semesters of Greek, got straight A's. I was a teaching assistant for Greek for 3 semesters. I tell that story because that's not any credit to how smart I am, because I'm actually not that brilliant, but it's a credit to David's wisdom in that moment to say, "Craig, what are you doing? What are you doing?" So Queen Esther has been asked by the king, "What do you want? Up to half my kingdom I'll give to you." And I wish we could read this in Hebrew, but we can't, because it's very poetic the way she says it. She says to the king, "Let my life be given to me, that is my wish, and the lives of my people, that is my wish and petition." So she says, "I want my life given to me." Can you imagine the king saying, what do you mean, your life given to you? Why would I need to do that? You're my queen. And then she adds the second line, "and the lives of my people." It's at that moment she confesses to the king for the first time that she's Jewish. Now, I'm in the minority report on the book of Esther. I think Esther is a book about genocide and it's about patriarchy. And the reason I think it's about patriarchy is because Esther is told to conceal her Jewish identity. Mordecai, who's her uncle, in Esther chapter 5 basically threatens her life if she tells anyone she's Jewish. She's afraid of Haman. She's even afraid of her husband. You see, this is what makes the story all the more powerful for me, is that she's the only person who breaks free of all 3 men controlling her to finally say, "Enough! Spare my life and spare the life of my people." Can you imagine the risks she takes in that moment to speak that kind of truth, to tell the king he's wrong without telling him he's wrong, and to deal with Haman? She reveals who she is. She reveals who her people are. She reveals Haman's plot. Good, you caught it. To kill everybody. And she reveals Haman. She points the finger right at him. What an amazing woman. She's taken everything into her hands in that moment to truth tell. So what do we learn about truth telling? Well, we learn a couple things from Esther. Number one, clear is kind. Sometimes when we have hard things to say to people around us, especially those closest to us, we try to soften our words. We try to nuance them to the point that they lose their meaning. And I would suggest that you follow Esther's example. Clear is kind. Say exactly what it is that is on your heart. Don't let there be confusion when you walk away from those conversations. Clear actually is kind. The second is seek to please God. That's Esther. If you listen to the podcast this week, you might have learned that in the book of Esther, the word God is never used one time. That's part of the poetry of the book, because Esther hid the identity of her God for 7 chapters. And it's not until she confessed her faith and her people that the Jews were saved. Until she does that, things get worse for the Jews all along. Until she confesses her identity, and then everything turns around in an instant for them. She sought to please God, not Mordecai, not Ahasuerus, and not Haman. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said this: our lives begin to end the day we become silent about the things that matter. And that was really the third key that I wanted you to hear in this story, that silence is not an option. She could not stay silent any longer. She stayed silent for one more minute. Her life and the life of all Jewish people would have been at risk in Persia. Silence wasn't an option for her. So some questions for you to wonder about this week. Are there hard situations that you're avoiding today? And what truth-telling could happen? And describe a time in your life when you were confronted by a friend. What was the outcome? My friend David Melton, who confronted me in the front seat of that car late that night when I was about 19 years old, went on to finish his degree and applied math. He became a high school teacher at San Luis Obispo High School, celebrated there, loved by his students. He died at 41 years old. He was the best man at my wedding. Just tragic. But I remember the day I gave the eulogy at his memorial, and I pointed to the story I just told you, that the thing about David that made him a remarkable man was his ability to tell the truth, even when we didn't want to hear it. And so that takes us to the last part of the story, which is incredibly difficult. This is the adult part of the story, friends. And it's this, that natural consequences are real. The king is enraged when he hears that Haman has been plotting to kill all the Jewish people, so he adjourns to the garden. The story tells us that all 3 of them had been drinking far too much wine, so he has to go out to the garden, kind of sober up a little bit. He enters the room and he finds Haman groveling at Esther's feet for mercy. This thing that's interesting in the story is when she confesses who she is as a Jewish woman, she does not say one more word in the story. Doesn't say anything. Now, the king believes that Haman is attacking her, so he orders Haman's death on the 60-foot-tall pike that he was going to stick Mordecai on. Sounds gruesome, doesn't it? And so the king, in his rage, sentences Haman to die for a crime he actually didn't commit. Is not the irony thick? Natural consequences are real. Let's be clear. Haman is evil. Seeking genocide of any group of people is an act of pure evil. It's an affront to all that is holy and sacred. It's one of the most fundamental truths in all of Judaism. Life is sacred, and we inherit that truth as Christians from our Jewish forefathers and foremothers. Life is sacred. When I was out on medical leave, I had a chance to watch a show on Apple TV called Masters of the Air. Did anybody watch it? A remarkable piece of television, and it was a story about aviators in the European theater in the Second World War who flew the B-17, the Flying Fortress, all over Germany and missions all over Europe. There's a story about one of the pilots who shot down, captured by the Germans. He manages to escape and find some Russians. The Russians are then taking him to an airfield where he can go back to England, where his base was. On the way, they have a broken down vehicle, and there's this set of buildings off to the side of the road, and so the pilot gets out and starts wandering around. He goes out to the set of buildings in an fenced area that the Russians had recently overtaken, and he stumbles onto the remains of a concentration camp. And as the character walks through the camp, and he begins to see and put together what's actually going on, the story is trying to depict for us some of the first uncoverings of what the Nazis were doing in the wholesale genocide of the Jewish people. That's evil, is it not? I would invite you to watch that show if you have Apple TV. If you don't find some other way, go to a friend's house to watch it. It's a remarkable story. When we talk about natural consequences, it's always very difficult for us. Because on the one hand, theologically, we're totally fine talking about the intervening grace of God and the power of God's love and wonder in the world, all of which are true. But do we not forget that the same God has ordered all things? Do we not easily forget that, theologically speaking, that this same God has ordered the very natural order of everything? That the natural consequences of actions are part of that order. Haman receives the natural consequences of his actions. And we have to reckon with that kind of mercilessness in the story. It's there to hold us in suspense. This week, there were university students across the United States protesting the war in the Holy Land. And they carried banners that said, "From the river to the sea," protesting against the Israelis. Do you know what that sign means? That the Jewish people should be exterminated from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. Surely they know not what they do. That the rise of neo-Nazism across this nation should concern us deeply. And likewise, what the Israelis have done for the last 60 years to the Palestinian people, that must be paid attention to. Displacement, building of walls, evicting families. One of the trips I took to the Holy Land, I saw the Israeli Defense Forces throwing a Palestinian family out of their house in the West Bank. Shocking, jarring. Part of the propaganda of the day in which we live is that we cannot the Israeli government has made it in a way that we cannot separate disagreement with what the government is doing from anti-Semitism and conflating those two things. Friends, there's evil being practiced on both sides of that conflict, and it should break our hearts to see the loss of human life. The totality of it is devastating. In this very heavy moment, we could talk about the consequences of climate change, we could talk about growing poverty, we could talk about crime. I could go on and on and on about the evil that we face in this age in which we live. Let's not forget that natural consequences are real, and all the more urgent for us as followers of Jesus to be agents of peace and reconciliation in the world. This is our calling. Blessed are the peacemakers. Remember, this is our work, is to step into these spaces where people are suffering deeply. The question I want to leave you with this morning is to think about where do you have those kinds of relationships that can speak a hard word? Where do you have those relationships that need to tell the truth? And where do you have those relationships that can open our eyes when we're completely blind to the natural consequences of our actions? You see, those relationships, those types of people, that requires intentionality, friends. Because none of us want to be in a relationship where we're told the truth. None of us like being in relationships where we're told what the natural consequences of our actions will be. We have to sink them out intentionally. Who are those people in your life? How are you making space for them on a regular basis because they are a means of grace to you. They're a way God speaks and moves. And so today, Pastor Camille is going to come share communion in a minute, but I want us to pause for a moment of silence. And in this silence, what I want us to do is to confess to the Lord how deeply we need these relationships in our life, how badly we need Esthers, and how badly we need to be an Esther. And let's just spend a moment in silence, and Pastor Camille will lead us.
Thank you.